So today we have a special speaker. She is the third of three postdoctoral fellows who are speaking in a row in our series in the last 3 weeks. Lucy Liu, she's a CWP fellow, China the World Program fellow for 2023 to 2024. Just like Sabina Mokri and John Minnick before her. She studies international relations generally and also has a regional focus on China, which is very much in line with the program's goals. She has a PhD from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 2023, and she researches China's global influence in various aspects of the international regimes and the international community, media, human rights, and foreign aid. And her dissertation shows how China gains influence in areas where you might not expect China to have influence, like in the human rights regime, because of the nature of the Chinese authoritarian system. You would think that would be a handicap, but China seems to be able to work around that in various ways to gain influence. And I believe she's going to present on that topic today. We're really thrilled to have Lucy here. We have a great cohort of three fellows in residence. And like the other residents, Lucy will be teaching this year here at Columbia. So if you haven't met Lucy, meet Lucy. If you haven't met Sabina and John, you should meet them. They also have office hours. So please avail yourselves of their wisdom and knowledge. And now I'll turn it over to Lucy Liu.
Awesome. Thank you so much for this warm introduction, Tom. And thank you all online and offline for coming here on the last day of this semester. I know it's very busy for time for everyone, so I really appreciate you coming and sharing your thoughts on my dissertation paper, which is Be My Friendly Reviewers, How China Shapes Its Reviews in the UN Human Rights Regime. So recent years, we have observed that China has demonstrated global leadership across issue areas like climate change, like trade, ICT, information and technology sectors, and also fostering South and South cooperation. I hope this combo of images can help me get the message across. So on climate change, it has made a really ambitious goal to align with the UN carbon emission reduction goal for all of the countries. It has deeply invested in renewable energy, like wind farms that we see here, and solar power. And we have seen that China has made some progress on attacking the problem of climate change. It also helped establish the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is one of the many existing development banks to help regulate loans and aids to developing countries. Huawei is one of the flagship companies in China to export the advances in 5G, and that has transformed the sector of ICT around the globe. And lastly, on BRICS, China has held a couple of summits in the past to demonstrate its leadership in this association that tries to counteract the power from the West. So in particular, I want to emphasize the map here, which is the artistic map showing the Belt and Road Initiative initiated by China. So as of 2022, there are already 147 countries being officially part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And for those who are not particularly familiar with this term, this is an umbrella term to refer China's ambitious foreign aid and overseas development project that goes all over the world, covering the sectors like natural resources, infrastructure, and so on. At the same time, it's also a very generous lender. It has lended about 83% of the total amount led by the World Bank and its partnering banks. And as a country on its own, it has outpaced G7 countries, individual G7 countries, and has become the single largest official source of international development finance to the global South. So On the ground, so the way Chinese aid operationalized is a little bit different from the traditional Western aid. So it has provided the so-called easier money with no political conditionality. And that has changed the ecosystem of foreign aid. So it's like doing business. It lends money to everyone who wants to do business with China with no attachment to how much human rights conditions that the countries need to improve or how many changes on the ground in terms of governing style, in terms of less corrupted government, etc. So we observed that in recent years, Western leaders, lenders seem to lose stakes in holding these countries more accountable with the political conditions they put in their trade agreements or aid agreements. Then we have observed that China has claimed global leadership in other issue areas. Then what about human rights regime? So in contrast to exerting influence in other issue domains that I just presented, it seems like China is vulnerable in the human rights regime. It has struggled to build a favorable image with its deteriorating internal human rights records, especially with the ethnic minorities in Xinjiang. It has received pushbacks from the West, from the citizens, from the multinational companies, or from the governments to issue boycotts or to kind of show their disapproval of China's position in this specific issue. Then I find that across issue domains, its ambitions in shaping international order and claiming leadership is interesting, and also in particular in human rights, as Tom alluded, it has a particularly difficult position to do that because of its ideology and its regime type, and also domestic practices are in direct contrast to the liberal-based norm. Namely, human rights is almost always associated with rights of individuals to express freely about their opinions, or to vote freely, or to believe their religion, believe and practice their religion. So I find this case would be a very interesting one to study and observe. So on research question, I ask, how can a major power like China improve its standing in the international human rights regime without actually improving its domestic compliance record? And I argue that it can wield its clout on foreign aid to developing countries in shaping the state-to-state reviews of its human rights conditions. And I want to show you that the Global South receptive to this power, to this overseas finance, refrains from criticizing its human rights practices. So there are three contributions that identified in that this project can speak to the literature. So first, there's not so much evidence of China's leadership in these most controversial and challenging areas of global governance. So human rights, as Professor Andy has pointed out decades ago, it is still a code word for subverting non-democracies. So people tend to associate human rights with the idea of democratization and westernization and the regime potential of regime change as a result of the idea of ideology erosion is the deepest fear in the Chinese leadership nowadays or in the past, or from the past to now. But as I said, China is overwhelmed with criticisms, right? It's hard to think. We always see China as a target of criticism from the international community. So how come and how possible it is to get around with it and be a leader in dispute? So I show that in the human rights regime, in particular in the UN, it actually plays by the rules set by the state-to-state review in the UN. And its position is not vulnerable. If we not just look at the Western countries, if we look at the Global South, we see a different picture. And it is not radical as well. It's trying to shape the human rights norms by emphasizing actually an existing dimension of rights, social economic rights, that has codified in a renowned treaty decades ago. So the second contribution is Light on Global South. I want to draw attention to this picture that we have in mind because the human rights issue is such a controversial issue that we often see that these two giant animals always talk and criticize each other and the other side would fight back. And in the media reports, we often see that this kind of Chinese human rights practices is such a morality play. China is always the bad guy and the West is almost always the good guy. Then what about this picture? So I want to draw attention to the position of Global South. So if we consider the human rights issue is such politicized, it's like a morality play, then we need to focus on the audiences. The audiences from the Global South, how do they process these debates, these controversy issues? Which side do they stand with? I think this is an important question to ask. But zooming out the competition between China and US, there has been rich literature in the past on Global South efforts in trying to shape new human rights norms and institutions to constrain the global north. So back in 1940s and 50s, so Latin American countries has helped to push pressure on adopting the language of human rights in writing the UN Charter and later helped establish the institution of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, one of the most founding documents or institution in the human rights regime. And fast forward in the past decade, it has refused a proposal put forward by the major countries like the US that advocated an only ad hoc international criminal court. But instead, it helped establish a permanent international criminal court, which is used to hold the most terrible leaders unaccountable and put them on trial if they violate the laws. And lastly, it helped advance like new business human rights norms to try to put more emphasis or more responsibilities on those multinational companies to take responsibility with the hazards or changes they made on the recipient countries, which are not necessarily always the good things. But the literature so far has not talked much about how China's Global South backs China in shaping new human rights norms. And lastly, I want to answer like this debate about an important question in the literature: can money buy influence, in particular in human rights? And there are two directions from economic deal to try to understand how economic deals are big countries can transfer power from economic deals to political influence. One is for better human rights compliance. So we have seen that countries like or IOs like EUs have strongly put forward the human rights as one condition in their trade agreements, foreign aid agreements, etc., in trying to force the countries who signed the economic deals with them to have a real improvement in human rights. Whether it's effective or not, we don't have a consensus yet, but this is a tool. Okay. And the second strand of literature is saying, yes, but those are for political gains. So human rights improvement is a key criteria for assessing for accessing EU membership. We see that some countries would use this as a transactional process to kind of gain the membership and stop improving afterwards. Another scholars would say that find that those who are closer in economic relationships tend to vote more closely in the UN in general. However, I see this literature has a difficulty of pinpointing exactly how material power can be transferred from the normative to the normative influence. So wrapping up my argument and contributions, I want to say that China has demonstrated moral leadership and is not vulnerable in the human rights regime. Second, Global South, if we look at it more closely, it seems to back up China in shaping new human rights norms. And I want to add to the literature debate that to what extent money can buy political influence. On the theory side, I want to show human rights are actually multidimensional with a fluid and expanding concept. There are many dimensions in human rights, and I will show you later in the table, but I want to draw your attention to two contested rights, especially between the US and China. One is on civil and political rights, and that is always at the center when we discuss human rights. So it has a liberal tradition grounded in democracy, and U.S. ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and that is one of the very few treaties it actually ratified. On social and economic rights, China always had the position of saying development first and rights come second. It has ratified many, many international treaties, but left ICCPR unratified. So my first hypothesis is that when we observe these multi-dimensions of human rights, I want to say China actually champions social and economic rights over other rights, and the Global South also does the same thing. The second hypothesis is on the relationship between aid beneficiaries and lenient reviewers. So there are two understandings in the literature. One is human rights regime is politicized, meaning that countries would use this human rights as a controversial topic to attack each other. And it would make it as an argument to advance its interests if this used cleverly. And across different international organizations, we also observe that states' relationships are actually politicized, meaning that states are friendly with their friends and more hostile to their enemies. And this study looks at the intersection between these two, human rights regime and the state-to-state interactions. So my second hypothesis is to look at the overseas finance the countries got from China is one measure or one indicator of how friendly it is with China economically. So I hypothesize that in the state-to-state reviews of human rights, states benefiting from Chinese overseas finance more tend to be more lenient reviewers of China. So on research design, I want to show a particular good data exploration that offers a unique laboratory to test my arguments. So this is a stylized picture generated by ChatGPT showing what the UPR might look like. So in the UPR, states get together in a room and to talk and to review each other's human rights practices. So first it is a opportunity to evaluate different aspects of human rights. So there are sets of human rights issues that countries could address in these universal periodic reviews. And it's very inclusive, 100% of participant rate, meaning that all the UN members participate in this system. And it's recurring through repeated cycles, started from 2008 up until today. So there has been three completed cycles, and the fourth one is ongoing. So at least we will have three complete set of data to work with. And the fourth is that it's relational. is a special forum to study state-to-state relationship in human rights, because state will be under, state in general is under review once in every cycle. For example, China was under review in 2009 in cycle one, 2013 in cycle two, in 2018 in cycle three. When I said China was under review, we were able to gather data that all the other UN member countries, how the, all the other member UN countries reviewed China's human rights conditions in the past 5 years. And each country can review other states multiple times. So this is a great opportunity to explore what reviews a country gets and how the country, when it becomes a reviewer, review other countries. One more slide on UPR. So it is not just a superficial mechanism that people, that states talk random things. So state representatives would draw on different sources of review materials. First, the states under review will submit a report evaluating its own human rights conditions before, during the cycle. And the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights will compile an official document stating their position about this country's human rights condition. And there are also a submission of stakeholders' information, like NGOs, civil society, and the meetings with these NGOs and civil society with the state representatives are especially encouraged in this process. So that was like before the review session. Well, during the interview session, there is an interactive dialogue between states. So states will be pretty selective with their comments given a limited time slot. So I argue that given a limited space of what comments it can raise, the reviewing state will pick the most important dimension of comments when it has a chance to speak. So after the review session, state under review also has power. It can go through each recommendation after the session and indicate acceptance. It will only implement the recommendations they accept for the next reviews. So next reviews will evaluate whether the accepted recommendations were actually implemented. So a little bit preview of how I analyzed these states' recommendations in the UPR review sessions. I gathered over 90,000 states' recommendations from three cycles in this form, like peer review system. And I implemented state-of-the-art research techniques, meaning text mining, text analysis. I use it to use different techniques to assess the alignment of human rights scripts, which I will explain what that means later in a minute. And I will also show you how lenient the states are when they review China in particular. So again, preview to test hypothesis one, we focus on the human rights scripts. I want to see whether Global South human rights scripts is similar to China's and how it is similar. I want to also look at the leniency. So to test hypothesis two, I want to check which countries are particularly more lenient towards China's human rights conditions and whether this is associated with the new Chinese aid project flows invested in that particular countries in between the review sections. Time. Okay, great. So on human rights script, remember a state can issue like multiple recommendations to a state under review. So throughout the cycles, throughout one cycle, a reviewing state would have multiple recommendations to one state, and there will be like multiple state under reviews, right? So there will be a ton of documents that in aggregate is a country's recommendation. And I argue that reflects a state's stance on human rights, on which dimensions are more important than the others. And then extract topics covered in each recommendation. So there's an NGO called UPR Info. If you don't know this organization, you can check out their website. It's pretty informative. It has issued, it has tried to analyze this recommendation and issued 56 non-inclusive texts for each recommendation. So the coding, the initial coding part was done by a third party from UPR Info. And what I did was to cluster them into eight topics responding to rights codified in one or more human rights treaties. And I put it in the appendix. If you have a question, I can talk more about that, the coding decision. And I used analysis based on these extracted topics distributions. So first is on word cloud description. And the second is on text similarity, but I didn't prepare it for this presentation, but happy to talk more about what I did for this similarity score. Okay. Okay, so before we, too fast. My God. Hey, no, sorry.
That's where you
were. Yes, okay. Awesome. So first on word cloud. Word cloud is basically a description about what topics, how topics are distributed. So the largest font means that this topic shows up the most frequent in this cluster of documentation. So how does China review others in this human rights script? Basically, it talks about social economic rights all the time. So the next question, interestingly, is how do Global South review China? It also adopts the same tone. When Global South review China, it also talks about its social and economic rights all the time. And this is an example of recommendations China received. On social and economic rights, Azerbaijan said that in cycle three, China has conducted the nutrition improvement program for children in poverty-stricken areas on a larger scale. Venezuela said the recommendations. They said continue to uphold a people-centered development approach. So these are the two examples of many recommendations China received on the issue of social and economic rights. And on race, ethnicity, and religious minority rights, Norway said China has to ensure full transparency on the situation of religious minorities in Xinjiang, including by allowing United Nations mandated observers unrestricted access to places of internment in this region. And the tag it receives is freedom of religion and belief and minority rights. And on civil and political rights, Australia said increase transparency of its traditional and social media by guaranteeing the rights of Chinese citizens to freely critique any state's organ or functionary. So you can see the tones are quite different when China is when China receives recommendations on different dimensions. The socioeconomic rights are much lighter than the other dimensions. So going back to the China's human rights script, so when China give recommendation to other countries, over 40 up to 50% of the times it talks about other countries' situation on social and economic rights. So it's at the very top at, in red, and on at the blue, which is at the very bottom, it very, very rarely talks about civil and political rights. And in the cycle three, the most recent cycle, there is zero recommendation on this particular right. What about the G7 scripts? Surprisingly, the civil and political rights is more frequently mentioned than the social economic rights, right? But it is still like after the more traditional rights on like physical integrity rights and protection of vulnerable population. And note that, and know that even for China, protection of vulnerable population and physical integrity rights are also the second and the third, although it's in a lower proportion. What about the Global South scripts? Again, the top two are also protection of vulnerable population and physical integrity rights, but socioeconomic rights are much more frequently echoed than civil and political rights. So if you think about the G7 is at one side of the pole and China is on the other side of the pole, and the global South script is definitely more closer with the, So US, China, global South is closer to China on human rights script. Next, moving to the second part of the analysis, which is on the leniency. This is an abstraction of what I did to the text-based data. So on each recommendation level, based on the topics it addresses and the level of action it indicates, I put leniency score for each recommendation. And then I use different techniques to sum up this recommendation at a state level. So basically, I get leniency score for the state's review. So we are able to see the aggregation of a state's position on what reviews a state give to another country. So we can analyze that any state as a reviewing state, how lenient this state is to other states. And as a state under review, how lenient other states to this particular state. Okay, so I make a general claim that this data can provide us opportunities to analyze a lot of problems, but this project focuses on China, right? So when China is under review, how lenient other states to China? But getting to that question, I also want to show you a bigger picture. How lenient are reviews China received compared to other states? So you can see China is actually at a very bottom. So like whatever country at the top receives the harshest review from other states. Can you see what country is at the top?
Yeah.
Yeah, United States.
I always want to be on.
So the US is at the top, China is at the bottom. Honestly, I was like pretty surprised that, oh, maybe the measures are wrong. So I've tried different ways and it shows pretty robustly, it seems to be the case. But happy to talk more about how I aggregate those. On cycle three, actually China's ranking bumps up, so meaning that other states are more critical to China, but still, United States is second. Like, it's at the same rank as Russia and Iran. Looking into the recommendations state US receive is an interesting direction, and happy to talk more about how future work can do that. But back to the reviews China get. I want to understand who tend to be the lenient reviewers. So this figure shows one possible relationship between the Chinese development projects invested in the recipient countries and the possibility of those countries being more lenient to China in cycle three compared to cycle two. So on the X-axis here, the horizontal axis there are three categories: small, medium, large, meaning that smaller amount of projects China invested in or gave aid or lent to the cluster of recipient countries. The middle is the medium increase. The large one is the largest amount of projects. And the y-axis here is a probability of the countries showing more leniency in cycle three compared to cycle two. And we can see those who receive the largest amount of development projects tend to be more lenient to China in cycle three. Then I think the original position of those reviewing countries are also important, right? So on the x-axis here, I changed the categorization differently. So here I looked at the how lenient the country was in cycle two to China. So from left to right were lenient reviewers, middle reviewers, and harsh reviewers, depending on the leniency score the country gives to China on their recommendations. Again, the y-axis is still the probability of showing more leniency in cycle three. The three symbols here is the project increments that was shown in the previous slide. So here we can see that for lenient reviewers, perhaps there's a threshold of how more lenient those reviewers can be with China in cycle three compared to cycle two. The effects are not there. But for middle reviewers and harsh reviewers, we can see that those who receive a higher amount of investment projects tend to be more lenient to China. Okay, I also, outside of the UPR, I want to give you another case in the UN resolution votes. I also get a question from Professor Andy and from other folks who have heard my talk. Does UPR matter? Why we care? Why states care? Why researchers care in general? So there's a case I want to draw your attention to in the UN resolution votes. There was a draft resolution on trying to debate China's alleged rights abuses against Muslim minorities in Xinjiang in 47-member UN Human Rights Council in October 2022. So basically, there was a report by the UN of high officials who went to China and wrote a report. And what this resolution was trying to do is to continue to debate this issue, talk more about the Xinjiang case. So US introduced this resolution. But you know what? This resolution was defeated. So that there were 19 countries voted against, 17 for, 11 voted abstained. And there are particular states who are members of the Organization for Islamic Cooperation who voted against and abstained. And you can read these countries here. And if you want to know more about why they make the case, so I can actually talk a little bit more about Indonesia case, but I also want to investigate more about how they defended their position to the public in the other countries.
Why did Ukraine up there?
Yes. Oh, it is a member.
There is not any organization for Islamic cooperation.
It is not. I'll have to double check, but I think from the reference I got, from the reference I checked, it seems to be. It shows that it is organized. It's in the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. So does UPR matter? To analyze these different positions of these countries, from this bar chart, we can see that from left to right, we first look at the right-hand side. For those who are harsh reviewers in the UPR system, they are much more likely to vote yes on the Xinjiang resolution. And for those who are middle reviewers and lenient reviewers, they are much more likely to vote abstain and no. So there are real world implications about studying how different countries have similar or different position with China in human rights, or how lenient they are with human rights records of China. But that also can go with like any type of state relationships. So a couple of takeaways from this talk. Yeah, and within time. That's great. Okay. So I want to show you that China is not vulnerable in human rights regime. And it's also not radical because it leverages the traditional defined dimension. One of the defined dimensions in human rights regime. It's not very typical when we think about what human rights mean when we talk about this term. So putting a spotlight on the Global South, I want to show that Chinese aid beneficiaries tend to back up China in shaping liberal-based human rights norms and its attempt to claim moral leadership which we think that is particularly difficult for a country like China, who is a authoritarian regime, to do so. And one strategy is what I call bring the periphery to the center. So what China is doing is try to bring the periphery rights in human rights, which is the social economic rights, back to the center. So we want to, so it attempts to expand the definitions of human rights, and it's attempting to look good in this slowly changing revised rubric, making it a C student to a B, even an A student in human rights. Yeah. So thank you so much. And this is me, Lucy, and this is my website.
Thanks very much, Lucy. I'm going to ask the first couple of questions that you might want to show. The first question I have is about the Global South. If you control for regime type in the Global South, does that affect the likelihood of leniency or harshness in criticism of China? Because you have percentage likelihood. You say if it's Global South, it's 60% likelihood for leniency. That means 40% of the Global South countries are still criticizing. But what's the correlation between liberal democracy in the Global South and criticism? How much of this is just authoritarians protecting authoritarians, and how much of it is money? And my second question is, what explains China's increased cooperation in cycle three? Is it Xinjiang? Is it COVID? That because COVID happened, sort of people had a negative view of China because COVID spread around the world and it started in China. Well, what's your explanation for why China rises in the charts? The U.S. always does poor rates, consistent.
So on the first correlation, I think you're absolutely right. So is the...
I don't know if I'm right. I actually don't know the answer. It's a real question.
Yeah. I think my data exploration also speaks to the concern that you had. So if we just put the regime type in the model, like the regime type will kind of blow away all the relationships. But if we control it more effectively, meaning cluster the country's regime types by a more refined categories. So not just like autocracy or democracies, but like basically
on a spectrum.
On a spectrum. Then we see like more effects are not on are on the money side, but less on the actual regime type.
Really?
Side.
Yeah. So the money factor is robust even if you control for if you allow variation in regime.
Yeah.
Type.
Yeah.
Wow. That's powerful. You should probably bring that out.
Okay.
Because that's, I think other people will think of that. So it makes your argument stronger that the money is talking.
But I also observe evidence like countries like Cuba has a very similar human rights grip with China, but like countries like Singapore also has like pretty good similarity score in terms of the human rights script Singapore put forward and with China as well. So I think there's more, regime type is definitely an important categorization, but there is more in the story.
So how about cycle three? Why does China do so poorly in cycle three compared to cycle one and two? What's your sense of, is it because Xinjiang got in the news, or is it because COVID happened and China's general diplomatic reputation took a hit because COVID.
So I think when China was under review in cycle three, there like COVID was not
pre-COVID.
Yeah, it was.
So COVID goes away.
So COVID, but canceled. Xinjiang issue was definitely more spotlighted in cycle three. But I also observed that in the discussion of cycle two and cycle one, like G7 countries also pointed out Xinjiang issue way before that the news talked about the camps, etc. But I also observed that actually countries are harsher to China in cycle three, right? Partially because this regime is not entirely politicized. It's not entirely dependent on what China wants people to, wants states to say. So a lot of states also can speak about sensitive issues that China does not want them to speak. In aggregation, I think the score, the increase of score shows this part. But I need to do further analysis about what drives the score change in cycle three.
Well, yeah. Others can ask questions.
Yeah.
John.
Yeah, John. Yeah.
Yeah, my question is, I think we're very careful in the final slide to point out that there's that countries that receive aid from China tend to be more lenient in their reviews of China and human rights. And you provided evidence that there's a statistical association between receiving aid and leniency in these reviews. But I'm just curious, how confident are you that it's the receipt of aid that is actually driving this relationship? And I guess the causal relationship there. And I'm just curious if you looked at alternative explanations, including various other forms of economic interaction with China that were also increasing at this time. So is it aid that's doing the work? Is it the expectation or the reality of foreign investment? Is it trade? Is it maybe things happening in the cultural and political domain? Just kind of thinking about the other factors that might be driving this relationship you're seeing, and if you've ruled those out.
That's a great question. So I'm hesitant to say that this is a causal relationship, but I think what I was implying was that we could possibly make a further argument on this specific point. So on another alternative hypothesis, yes, I agree that when we look, so aid more broadly is only one type of economic relationships China and that particular country has. Of course, FDI and trade are also important. Right now, I haven't really figured out whether these factors are also important, but if they are, that also helps my argument, but it's important to put them.
So it's economic, but it's
Yeah.
And I think you have to think about aid, because aid is a kind of a loaded term in mm-hmm. China field. So, like Deborah Brodigan is always pointing out, China doesn't give much aid.
Yeah,
it gives loans and it wants to be repaid. Yeah. That's not aid.
Yeah,
they want the money back.
Yeah.
So it just maybe you want to rephrase that as infrastructure loans or all the AI the BRI stuff.
Yeah,
most of that is not aid.
Yeah. So I use the development. I want to answer the question a little bit more. Yeah. So on the loans part, I agree. I use the new development projects in my access, but in my presentation, I use it very loosely. I just use aid to refer all different types of financial relationships. But on the other hypothesis, I actually think that in addition to different dimensions of economic relationships, there could be other types of state-to-state relationships. Mm-hmm. It could be reciprocal relationship, right? You scratch my back, I scratch your back. So I think next iteration, I would examine whether that's the case. And there is a possibility of, there's other possibility, but now it's different, right?
It's a two-bing because it just picks up from this. So one theory might, I don't know how to test this, but one theory might be that every state thinks about itself only, a narcissistic theory. And it thinks, what are people criticizing me about? Whatever they're criticizing me about, I will never mention in any criticism I direct at anybody else. It has nothing to do with who the other country is or my relationship with them. It's all about me. I don't know how to test that. The other, but it would be a null hypothesis. It would be a pure null hypothesis to your theory. The other one is that this is outside the bounds of the research that you've done. But I mean, I find your argument very convincing. But then one might wonder, what is the process? So the causal mechanism. So is the causal mechanism that the the other country just knows what China wants, or is there actually any interaction where the Chinese embassy in that country comes to them and says, we would like you to say this or that, or the Chinese mission in Geneva, you know? So of course that's a whole different kind of research, and I don't think it's in your data, but it's just an interesting question.
That's great. So some thoughts on not about me alternative hypothesis. So on if you remember, so on the Global South script, they overall has put like civil and political rights at the very bottom. So very few of them mentioned these rights at all in their scripts. So I can see that, okay, what about the Global South's more democratic countries?
Yes, like Liberia is pretty democratic.
Yeah, also tend to not mention this particular right. So in terms of getting cues, I think it is totally possible, right? Because like those different review sessions happened at different moments. So perhaps we have, leverage the different time that China is reviewed or China reviews other countries to see whether China's cue on specific rights it wants to highlight can be picked up by other countries subsequently. But that's for like future analysis. But I think it's totally possible to figure out what kinds of cue or whether the cues are picked up.
Does the U.S. lobby in countries,
or I don't care, say whatever you want.
I don't recall us lobbying countries not to criticize us on human rights. In fact, China wrote a human rights report when I was at the State Department running China Plus. Yeah, they wrote a report.
Good report.
Yeah, they wrote a report criticizing China, and some of my this is just for this room, right? This is just for this room. So some of my colleagues were like, oh, how dare they, you know? And I said, this is good. I said, as long as they use universal norms in criticizing us, we can take it. And at least China's now using universal norms, not saying we have our Chinese definition of human rights and you have your American definition. They're using universal standards, and we can take it. And you know, maybe we could use some criticism. I even said that they would criticize us for executing an intellectually challenged 17-year-old or something in Louisiana. I was like, that's probably good for us. You know, now let's talk about, and when we did the human rights dialogue, it's a little bit of a diversion. It was down for 6 years. And when we did the human rights dialogue, I worked with David Kramer, who you probably know from your work. He's a wonderful person. He was a great assistant secretary. And when we opened the dialogue in Beijing, he gave a speech, and we wrote the speech, and it was a 30-minute exposition on U.S. human rights violations, going back to slavery, Jim Crow, genocide of the Native Americans. And we said, we did all this stuff. We violated international norms, not American norms. We violated international norms, and we made all these mistakes. Now let's talk about your mistakes. And they were visibly impressed by this approach. I don't think we got anybody released from prison in the process, but they were impressed by our approach. And I think it's the right way to go at it. But anyway, that's my take on it. I don't recall us lobbying. I think we sometimes lobby people because we think we in the State Department have thought that Israel gets unfair levels of criticism. And I think we've criticized other countries for being hyperactive in their criticism. You see how Israel is always toward the top in your list. But I don't think we do it on our own behalf. And I don't think we should, but maybe we have in the past. I didn't see it. So one thing that China can do, and I've seen this in a different context than just human rights, is I was in the construction industry before I came to Colombia. So I used to hear noises like this, and that is to say, we're making really good progress on the cooperation on issue X. I wouldn't want to see the atmosphere harmed by, you know, political outcome that is unfavorable to the continuation of our cooperation.
It's worse than we do.
And it always sounded to me like someone saying to a shopkeeper, you know, it's a beautiful shop you have, and I wouldn't want to see it burn. So what we would get on Taiwan policy, we would get we're really working hard in the 620 talks on North Korean denuclearization. I would hate to see the spirit of that cooperation damaged by arms sales to Taiwan.
So I have a question that kind of relates to Andy's first point, and I was wondering whether you could kind of compare the human rights stances that you extract from the UPR to the country's kind of other proclamations about human rights to have like another point of comparison to where they stand on human rights. And that could kind of help you to also show how important the UPR is in talking about human rights more generally, because I thought your point about the links between the UPR and the this resolution that you had were really powerful and insightful. So maybe you could also draw such other comparisons.
Yeah, so that case was a pretty rare case because China was barely put into a formal process in the UN to get votes. So there's not many cases to also observe states' position on China's human rights conditions outside of this case, but like perhaps historically, I can look a little bit.
There's the EU.
Yeah, I meant like policy papers and stuff that those states issue. The individual countries. So
EU does human rights reports as an organization. And I know that in one instance, and it's a kind of famous case, and you can look into it, and you can probably get people who talk about it. It is the case of Greece in the EU after the Piraeus Port incidents. They blocked an EU statement criticizing China. I think it was on Xinjiang, but it could have been on human rights more generally. So there was no EU statement about China that year because the EU is a consensus organization. Every country has to go. So if China can peel one country off, then there's no statement. So you can do a kind of cross comparison in the future and be more convincing. I think that case works. And then I did research in 2019, when you could still travel, to Southeast Asia, and I talked to people about why these Islamic majority states were not criticizing on Xinjiang. And there was like real embarrassment. It's very consistent with your thesis that they say, you know, it's too risky for our economies to criticize China. So it was very much the money, and especially the student body was embarrassed. I had gave one talk where like most of the women in the room had hijabs on and stuff, and they were not happy that they were in a situation where the government wasn't criticizing China but Xinjiang. But they all kind of hinted or said explicitly, it doesn't make sense to do it publicly. They did say that diplomats sometimes raise it privately and say, you know, this makes us unhappy, but to say it publicly and to make China lose face would be bad for their economics.
I also had the anecdote to share because I also shared my research project, but with more focus on Indonesia when I presented to a university in Indonesia. So there I used what recommendations Indonesia gave in throughout the three cycles. And the researchers there were like really shocked to see that Indonesia gave a very, very light criticism on China. So they never mentioned like anything related to minority rights.
Yeah. So Indonesia, you should talk to Anne-Marie Brady. I talked to her about it. She's affiliated with the Weatherhead East Asia Institute. She was my classmate at Columbia. Wonderful scholar of Southeast Asia. But she argues that not only does China have the economic relationship like the infrastructure investment in the Bandung Jakarta Railroad, but also China actually gives aid. This is real aid. Gives aid to Islamic schools in Indonesia. You wouldn't expect this from a Marxist-Leninist state, but they give aid to the madrasas in Indonesia because those are the places that are most likely to criticize China on human rights issues, and they're kind of bought off.
Interesting.
I didn't know that. I mean, she's a wealth of knowledge about Southeast Asia.
Yeah. Thank you.
I had a question.
I was curious with the PC
Chang, the graduate of Columbia that had been studying here on the Boxer Indemnity Scholarship, and he was, you know, one of the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I was wondering, I haven't seen him in a lot. I would understand like why he wouldn't be like the best figure for the CCP to highlight, but how does the CCP treat PC Chang as you know, a drafter of the Human Rights Universal Declaration, if at all?
I think it's an interesting question. I definitely need to look more into that. So I know that PC Chang has helped a lot on kind of demonstrating the global, like the developing countries' narratives in drafting the UNDCR. So not just like using the kind of the model from the US, right? They PC Chang's position along with others need spend a lot of efforts to trying to incorporate like diverse opinions about what human rights need to be in a UN setting. So I could look into a little bit more about how Chinese government talked about this person. I know that I didn't know much about the official narrative, but he was so important. But I think he would be a really nice figure that China nowadays could leverage. But yeah, I'm curious about what the official discourse about him would be.
He was KMT, so that's the problem. He was KMT in the Civil War period, 45. Mm-hmm. So there's a new book by my Princeton colleague Gary Bass that talks about the Tokyo trials. Mm-hmm. And he has a whole section on Mr. Chang and the writing of the UN Declaration mm-hmm. of Human Rights. I have heard CCP representatives in track two discussion say China was an original drafter of the human rights mm-hmm. Of human rights in the UN Charter.
Yeah.
China, they said.
Yeah.
That's Mr. Chang. But China, that was a KMT China, not CCP China.
Yeah.
Had you already gone to Paris? Like when was it?
This all happened in 45.
45 minutes.
Yeah, so it was very much Chiang Kai-shek's government on the mainland, and he was ROC. He was an ROC representative.
Okay. Did he go to Taiwan after 49?
Oh, I don't know his whole history. I honestly don't. But I would check out Gary's book, called "Verdict in Tokyo" or something like that. Judgment in Tokyo.
I also have another or conceptual question. So when you started out, you were talking a lot about Chinese moral leadership, and then in the I'm very convinced that the UPR data is really useful, but isn't it just like defending against criticism? There is just state-to-state criticism, and I was wondering what's the link between moral leadership and kind of fending off criticism.
What do you mean fending off criticism?
Well, the only thing that if it's like you get, so what states are doing there is criticizing each other, right? And the only thing that if you are criticized is that you can do is that you can kind of get rid of the criticism or defend yourself against that. But is that moral leadership?
I use the moral leadership very loosely. I would say why I put moral in front as an adjective of leadership is because the human rights issue has normative stance, right? So you always think about human rights issues as if it is a very controversial topic, right? Whether this country has violated human rights, has tortured prisoners, etc. So what if the country has done that, then is morally deprived. So that's why I use moral as an objective of leadership and indicating that China has found a really hard time of trying to claim leadership in this specific area. But on the UPR, I think a lot of scholars or the people who use UPR would think that it is an opportunity for states criticizing each other. But from the examples you saw, like, it's actually an opportunity for states cheering each other. Mm-hmm. So it could pick a very, very light dimension and saying that you have done a really good job, continue to do that. So not sure is exactly about criticism mm-hmm. on human rights, but I think it's a rare opportunity to observe how states try to balance how much they claim to this like kind of moral principle of human rights, defending human rights norms in this rare opportunity versus how, like what exactly it speaks to, whether it, like what kind of positions it takes. And I would say that even though a lot of countries kind of cherry picking and tend to be very light to China, if the media does not say much about it, like in aggregation, like the public don't really know about what their state representatives actually talk about in the UPR. So it's more like a show between states. But like these interactions obviously are observed by the civil society and NGOs, but by human rights scholars, like who pay attention to these interactions, but not perhaps not to the general.
Thank you, Lucy, for your wonderful presentation. I learned a lot. As you mentioned that the data analysis on a script, you said there are more than 50,000 scripts. Yeah. And that's one variable. And the other one is the money, right? So I'm really curious about, you mentioned AIIB and some bilateral government finance. So which you think is the most important channel for China to influence those global sales, if you can give like these 50,000 cases, and which percentage is by AIIB, which percentage is by maybe Belt and Road Initiative, there will be maybe clear for the audience to know, oh, that's important because it's how much money and which percentage by which channel. That would be also interesting. That's my personal opinion. And it's a good model, but I'm also curious about maybe there's some outliers, not like Azerbaijan, not like Thailand. Maybe there's sometimes UK or Japan who give positive opinion about China. Did you find that? What's your opinion about that unexpected review of those special cases?
Great question. So on what ratios of the money, how important those money are, and how, so I think there, on another project, I looked at the scale of the monetary flow, the relationship between the scale of the aid flow and the human rights scripts similarity score. I didn't show it here. I probably should use the similar research design to understand the leniency as I showed in this project, because that would be like more powerful. So in this study, I just looked at how many projects, but I didn't explore how big those projects are and how important those projects are to the countries. So this is definitely a important follow-up study to conduct, but on what channels, whether those are aid, whether those are loans, FDI with AIIB, like what kinds of, what specific channels in the economic relationships are more important? I think that also speaks to John's earlier point, right? I think it's important to analyze, which aspects seem to be more important. And I think that also depend on the recipient countries as well. So on the outlier, I think that's interesting. So I didn't look at the leniency in particular. So one surprising one is on Indonesia, right? So as I said, it never talks about like the minority issues that China faced. But like on outliers, so on another study, again, looking at the similarity between state script on human rights and China script, I find that, like, so I divide the countries into like warm, middle, and cold countries. So in there, I also find that some developed countries actually adopt a similar, like a more similar human rights groups with China than other developed countries. So like France, it has been like, its human rights groups has been closer and closer with China across the three cycles. And I don't know why, but I think that would be like one outlier that I can think of. And I would like to know a little bit more about what exactly France has been like, giving recommendation to others.
So it's not positive, it's just less negative than the other European countries.
Yes.
Less negative. Yeah.
So there's a question online from Ian Johnson from Harvard University. He says, great project. I like the deep dive into the review process, but for many global South countries, social and economic rights have long been a major pillar of global human rights norms. This position predates China's efforts to use economic incentives to get support on human rights from the global South. For example, right after the Tiananmen Square massacre, from the early 90s through 2021, China was able to mobilize a majority of states in the UN Commission on Human Rights to oppose tabling resolutions critical of China. A democratic India would often oppose such resolutions, and a democratic South Korea would abstain. So the support for China or opposition to criticism of China predates BRI and major increases in China's aid and trade in the global South. What might be other sources of this solidarity with China on social economic rights, since it goes back pretty far into history and in some cases cuts across the democracy authoritarian divide? One of our former fellows of the program, Manjari Miller, might suggest shared imperial ideology. That's something to further follow up on.
Her thesis is that India and China have a lot in common because they were both great empires that were abused by Europeans, and that they have a kind of bond that's built from that. So they don't like European criticism.
Yeah, so thank you for this great question. I think, yeah, before coming to Colombia, I actually thought that it's like a pretty new phenomenon, but after talking to Ian over email and also attending Andy's class, I know that it has a really long historical route for Global South to champion social and economic rights as well.
Mm-hmm.
So part of this evidence is also shown in its human rights groups in general, right? So the first half of the study shows that, like, independent of China's influence, on like when the Global South reviews other countries, it all like also highlights the social and economic rights, not only to China, like to everyone, right? So I think this interesting contrast is there. I think the follow-up study would be to tease out exactly like whether this Global South country treats China differently, right? To compare their reviews to China versus their reviews to like other Global South countries, for example. So I think there is an important alternative hypothesis to tackle. And I'll keep that in mind and try to play around with it before the next iteration of this new project.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is really interesting. A question I have is the effect of this on discourses within the countries that have officially shifted their narrative. So I'm curious about, is there a shift that you can detect that goes not just from the official or just below that level, but also amongst civil society? If so, what are the mechanisms by which that is happening? In other words, once a state adopts a more favorable stance towards China, do they then take action to enforce that within civil society? So clamp down on narratives that may then contravene the official narrative on some of China's activities. I'm thinking perhaps an interesting example might be Turkey, which was once quite strongly against or was quite outspoken about Xinjiang and then changed that. So did that then trickle down into civil society, or is there now a gap almost between the official narrative and then how civil society is thinking about and talking about this?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I don't have a good answer to that. But what I know is that there are, like, before each review session, especially though that state is under review, right? It collects information from the civil society and NGOs, etc. And it cares a lot about this input from the civil society. So, but I would say that those organizations would hold the state accountable when it is under review. So meaning that when Turkey is under review and Turkey gets a lot of recommendations from other countries, right, those civil society would keep an eye on whether Turkey actually implements the recommendations it adopts it when it is under review. But I guess it would be less that's just my speculation. I think it would be less possible to keep track of what Turkey, like what recommendations Turkey give to other countries and how those recommendations are fair or unfair, to make it simpler. So unless media reports talk about it, right? Unless we talk about, okay, why Indonesia does not condemn China on this specific issue, right? Unless there's like specific case that associated with state position, I think the civil society would kind of talk more about it. But I think in general, following up the UPR recommendations, that particular state to other countries, I think the civil society would have less resources or energy to keep track of what the issues.
I just wanted to say something about Turkey. It's not related directly to your thesis, but my impression was that Turkey was the one Islamic majority country,
mm-hmm.
Muslim majority country that criticized China over Xinjiang, which is really extraordinary. It's the one.
Mm-hmm.
But my impression was that it wasn't done out of Islamic solidarity. It was a nationalist position by Erdogan about Turkic peoples, because Turkey considers itself the leader of the Turkic peoples of the world, and the Uyghurs are considered of Turkic minority, of Turkic origin, and he was being a nationalist, not a religious rights proponent. I don't know if that's true, but I it makes sense to me given his general ideological posture as the great leader of Turkey, that he would be emphasizing that. But it doesn't really affect his thesis in any way. It just came up because of the example.
I suppose another example possibly is Central Asia, because there have been quite a lot of protests that have been quite explicit. They've been quite small, but they've been very explicitly about Xinjiang, which is different to the government. I suppose another example is Central Asia, where I think there have been enough protests that seem to be that have been directly critical of Xinjiang, but which suggests that there is a gap, at least amongst some civil society and the government, right? I mean, it's difficult though, isn't it? Because you have to survey so many different countries. But I just wonder whether it just strikes me that, you know, it's one thing that if the official narrative changes, but then what about, especially in countries with big Turkic populations, how do they respond?
But I bet you the U in your list, it's Ukraine. I bet you it's Uzbekistan.
Maybe
Ukraine doesn't have a lot of Muslims.
Okay. Yeah,
I'll get that. Every country, like every large population country, has some, but I don't think it has a lot of Muslims.
And I also don't know what the organization.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation. I think I think the members, if I'm not mistaken, are Muslim majority countries. Ukraine's not a Muslim majority.
Yeah.
So it might just be you, and it just got autocorrect or something. It stuck out. I won't be the only one that notices Ukraine up there.
Yeah.
Now, Ukraine has not been highly critical of China, and people speculate, this is consistent with your thesis, that Ukraine is very interested in the prospect of rebuilding Ukraine after the war is over,
mm-hmm.
and China would be an obvious partner in rebuilding infrastructure destroyed by the Russian military. So why alienate China in advance by emphasizing, even though Ukraine is very much appealing to its solidarity with the liberal democracies of Europe and the world, as an example of a liberal democracy being attacked by an authoritarian state, it hasn't targeted China for
criticism as an authoritarian state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be interesting to look at that too.
But that's prospect. That's the prospect of future investment, not the right.
Thank you. I'm very interested in your revised rubric ending. Do you think of the future of the Chinese efforts to change the definition or norm of human rights?
I think it's interesting. So I think China has used this rhetoric for quite a long time. Either people don't take it seriously, thinking that it's just like one thing to counteract the criticisms they've received from the West, or thinking that, oh, when we talk about human rights, developmental rights is not a good place to talk about, right? So there are possibly two kinds of mindsets here. So what I show here is that one, it seems to be a pretty, so like talking, like using this rhetoric seems to be really effective, not just to domestic audiences, but also to the international audiences in terms of state representatives in the UN, right? So one message I want you all to take away from this talk is that, okay, it seems like China is trying to expanding the kind of the traditional definition of human rights. We should take developmental rights more seriously. And look, the global South, a lot of countries also take a similar view, right? And two, by emphasizing the economic rights, China actually is scored much better than in the traditional rubric, where the civil and political rights is the most important rights that we associate with the human rights. So I don't know what to do. I don't know whether this is a good approach for China, but I think it is a pretty effective one to kind of show that it is not very vulnerable in the human rights regime, because if we look at like more countries like outside of the US, Australia, like actually other countries are like pretty lenient towards China's human rights conditions in general. At least they don't want to openly criticize what everyone's been doing.
Okay, thanks. We have our own human rights policy, which means we don't ask you too many questions. You can now have dinner. So thank you very much.